This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford. My co-host Nellie Bailey is off this week. Coming up, a conference against austerity and predatory banks in Detroit. The Supreme Court gets another shot at affirmative action. And American exceptionalism. It's just another way of saying white supremacy on a global scale. But first, the diplomatic process was the last thing the Obama administration wanted in Syria. But thanks to the Russian initiative, talks on chemical weapons are now underway. We spoke with Sarah Founders of the United National Anti-War Coalition, UNAC.
Well, I think the most important thing right now is to understand what happened and what has not happened. President Obama announced a press conference, which was to be an announcement of war. And a funny thing happened on the way to that press conference, literally the day before. He was already up against complete international opposition, and it was clear he did not have the congressional vote. No matter how much arm twisting and NSA blackmail they had on every member of Congress and every way of pressuring the vote, they weren't going to get it because the overwhelming majority of the population in this country is against the war. It's not off the table, and they are consciously and thrashing everywhere to find a new excuse, a new way to rev up another war threat. But for right now, even the congressional vote is postponed. It is a tactical retreat that gives the anti-war movement more time to mobilize and to understand what happened and what has not happened. They couldn't wage the war they want when they wanted. That doesn't mean that they're not going to do it, because it's still very much on the table. And even Obama's talk, you thought almost until the last minute that was an announcement that aircraft had already taken off with the way he was speaking, and then suddenly he sort of switched gears.
Yes, as we remarked, it did seem that that portion of his speech, which he saved for almost last, was cut and pasted in.
It certainly had that feel. Here he gave a warlike, bellicose talk, again based on all the repeated lies that U.S. has been telling the whole world, and again saying that Syria was to blame, Syrian government used chemical weapons without a fact given, just an assertion, and a completely untenable lie, as a matter of fact. Why on earth would the Syrian government, who has defeated overwhelmingly the rebel forces and encouraged, invited, pleaded with the U.N. chemical weapons inspectors to come to Syria, on the day they land, why on earth would they fire gas just 10 miles from where the inspectors were? It doesn't even fit the rationality test.
President Obama says he's going to hold his forces, his military forces, in a state of readiness. How is UNAC's readiness in terms of how the administration might treat these diplomatic efforts?
Well, very much. Everything from UNAC and all of its member parts, that's the United National Anti-War Coalition, and from my own organization, International Action Center, we're very much part of UNAC. Across the country, UNAC was building these demonstrations, and as soon as the announcement was made, was also discussing how to stay literally alert for the next step and the next crisis. And to say to people also, this is still coming. This war has not been put off. It's been temporarily postponed. It's looking for another example. And this happened, by the way, we should just think back to 2003. There were actually several times where it was postponed. There was a new round of negotiations, a new hysteria about weapons of mass destruction, and then weapons inspectors' reports that there was nothing there, UN reports there was nothing there, and then a new round of charges, and then finally U.S. acted without UN authorization, and taking what they had had in the bag from the October before congressional vote authorizing diplomatic measures, but all necessary steps. So at the time, Bush claimed he had congressional authorization and they went forward with the war. So I think there's very much the same scenario that is being set up. But this time, I will say, Syria is far less isolated than Iraq was in 2003 or than Libya was just 2 years ago in terms of countries in the region, whether we're talking about Iran or Russia, Hezbollah forces in Lebanon, an aroused Arab population, an aroused world movement. It was a disaster, Obama's visit during the G20. He couldn't get any of the support he was expecting. Went there talking war, and everyone backed off. So this was put on hold, but I really think we have to stay completely on the alert for U.S. war on Syria, and also to know that they may turn this to threatening another country because they live to sell and promote and carry out war. That's their huge source of profit in an economic system that's in crisis, that's in real crisis and has to find ways constantly to extract profit from a dying system.
Sarah Flounders of the United National Anti-War Coalition, speaking from New York. President Obama ended his speech on Syria last week, citing the so-called exceptionalism of America, a doctrine that has historically justified U.S. defiance of international law. Ajamu Baraka is the founder and former president of the U.S. Human Rights Network and an associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. He says American exceptionalism means the U.S. claims rights and privileges that are the legacies of colonialism.
It's deeply ingrained in the consciousness of the American public, this notion that they have some kind of special history, some special gift that allows them to ignore international law, international standards, and international morality, and to decide for themselves the international order, that they have the right and the responsibility to be the judge, jury, and executioner when it comes to the global order. They have the right and the responsibility to invade, to bomb, to arrest, to murder, at will. And that idea, the foundation of it, is rooted in a notion of unacknowledged white supremacy. That right, that responsibility, is the colonial right and responsibility of colonists for the last 500 years to determine who has the right to sovereignty, who has the right to rule, who should be the authority in certain countries. It's nothing more but the dressed up and re-articulation of the white man's burden.
So American exceptionalism is the ultimate declaration of white privilege. Isn't it ironic, an irony of history, that a black man is invoking it?
It is, but it shows the reality of a white supremacist ideology, that it doesn't really matter who might be articulating that particular notion. It goes beyond pigmentation. And that's the lesson that I think that we're going to come away with from this Obama period. Because it's becoming clear now to many people that the Obama administration and Obama himself personally are no more but stand-ins for the continuation of the rule of the white corporate and financial elite. And that what drives that financial and corporate elite is their commitment to maintain white hegemony, white power basically, white capitalist power. So it doesn't really matter the pigmentation or the gender or whatever of the individuals who are occupying these positions in the state. We still have undergirding the state, undergirding the organization of the society, the continuation of white power. And that, I think, is going to be the lesson that will help to further radicalize people here in this country.
Russian President Vladimir Putin, in his letter published in the New York Times, letter to the American people, spoke of this belief in American exceptionalism and warned about it.
And one of the things that has exposed the phony nature of this exceptionalism and this concern for humanity that Putin sort of hinted at in his New York Times op-ed was the selectivity of the humanitarian concerns. Now, here we're supposed to believe that the U.S. is concerned about these hundreds of people who are gassed in Syria, but yet we're then supposed to ignore what we saw right before our eyes with hundreds of people, and some people have now said thousands, who were murdered in the streets of Cairo in Egypt, a U.S. ally in which the U.S. couldn't even bring itself to suspend military aid for quite some time and never characterized what happened in Egypt as a coup. Obama tells us to look at the pictures of the dead coming from Syria. Well, we remember the pictures of dead children who were circulating on the internet after the latest incursion, if you will, by the Israelis in the Gaza Strip. We have 1.5 million Palestinians packed in like sardines in the biggest open-air prison on this planet, who were the recipients of the might of the most powerful military in the so-called Middle East, who rained death and destruction down basically defenseless people. What about their humanity? Don't they count? Where's the humanitarian intervention for Gaza? So this notion of American exceptionalism, America being the arbiter of morality for the world, for those of us who have been the victims of America's morality, America's practice, we see it for what it is, a phony cover to provide a justification for the continuation of U.S. imperialism and hegemony.
And one cannot expect good faith diplomacy from a party that begins the conversation claiming to be an exception.
The notion of American exceptionalism, we have to explode that myth because it has a grip not only on the minds of many white Americans, but we see they had made some inroads in the consciousness of even some African people in the U.S. and others. And if we don't undermine this foundational rationality, then we're not going to be able to develop the kind of critical awareness, critical consciousness that's necessary to build a more effective movement in opposition to both the Democrats and the Republicans, both parties that are representing the interests of the 1% here in this country. So we're not surprised that the Democrats, who've always been hawks, have rallied behind, many of them have rallied behind Obama, and are actively attempting to try to convince our people and other people to support him in this latest adventure in Syria. But I can say this, I'm very proud of the fact that as confused and strange it has seemed that African American people have been over the last 5 years in following Barack Obama, when it came to this latest episode, this trying to bring the U.S. into alignment with the interests of the 1% to attack Syria, African-American people said in overwhelming numbers, no, no. And that's something that we can be proud of and we can build on as we go forward.
Ajamu Baraka of the Institute for Policy Studies. He's also an editor and columnist for Black Agenda Report. The Obama administration and the U.S. corporate media have stated, as if it were a fact, that Syria has kept its chemical weapons a secret until now. But that is a lie. Sam Husseini of the Institute for Public Accuracy explains.
Syria has admitted in the past, I don't know how far back, but I know as of last year, I found an article in the American Interest magazine headlined, Syria acknowledges chemical weapons. So this is a lie. I've heard John Kerry say it. I've heard numerous commentators and congresspeople say it. There's no basis in that claim. What's particularly ironic about it is that it is Israel that does not acknowledge its possession of nuclear weapons. Barack Obama, at his first news conference, was asked by the recently deceased Kellen Thomas if he knew of any country in the Middle East that had nuclear weapons. And he said that he didn't want to, quote, speculate, close quote. No one was asking President Obama to speculate. He just simply doesn't want to acknowledge the reality of Israel's nuclear weapons, and no sitting president has done so since Richard Nixon and Golda Meir came to an agreement on this. So it's not only a falsehood, it's the worst type of hypocrisy. The U.S. is continuing to do exactly, vis-a-vis Israel's nukes, exactly what it claims Syria has done in relation to its chemical weapons.
And of course, President Obama was not contemplating bombing Tel Aviv or bombing Cairo because they have not signed the treaties regarding chemical weapons.
Absolutely. I think that Israel just recently signed the chemical weapons treaty, but it hasn't ratified it. And everything that I've been able to find indicates that Israel is continuing to build up its chemical weapons capacity. The United States is a signatory and was supposed to get rid of all of its chemical weapons several years ago. They got an extension up until 2012, and then they reneged on that extension. The relevant agency is hoping that the U.S. will comply by 2018, but the U.S. is saying that it won't comply at the earliest at 2023. The pattern that we're seeing vis-a-vis Israel, you say, you know, the U.S. doesn't threaten Israel on this matter. The International Criminal Court has basically only been for African leaders. That is, only African leaders get hauled before the European-based International Criminal Court. And we're seeing a similar pattern with Arabic leaders. Only Arab countries, it seems, are compelled to disarm. You had Saddam Hussein forced to disarm, and then a slew of lies and propaganda about his failure to disarm his weapons of mass destruction, which were the pretext for the Iraq war and the invasion. And then Gaddafi disarmed his weapons of mass destruction, and they both met similar fates, and now Syria is being compelled. The underlying policy, it seems fairly clear to me, is to preserve the monopoly of Israel of having weapons of mass destruction in the region. So I think in the long term, one needs to keep track of what happens to Egypt's capacity. Israel basically does not want anything to counterbalance its overwhelming destructive weapons of mass destruction capacity, which is why they've been demonizing Iran.
Corporate media types are talking about the Obama administration allowing diplomacy for a while to take its course, but this administration is still threatening, just as it did before, to attack Syria, and a threat to attack a nation is, in fact, also a violation of international law and not a very diplomatic thing to do.
Absolutely. I mean, everybody is sort of saying that diplomacy might work here. Well, it's not diplomacy if you're threatening the use of force. The UN Charter prohibits not just the use of force, but the threat of the use of force, and not just the use of force. You know, it's like if I go into a store and wave a gun around and rob everybody, I don't have to actually fire the gun to not have broken the law. And that's rather what the U.S. is doing here. It is using the threat of the use of force and coercion and so on. And I think that people are falling into the trap of thinking that this somehow constitutes diplomacy. Real diplomacy, unless you consider diplomacy war by other means. Genuine diplomacy would be like, we want you to get rid of your chemical weapons. Oh, what's that? You're concerned about Israel's nuclear weapons capacity? Okay, well, maybe we should have a weapons of mass destruction free zone in the Middle East. Well, actually, Syria proposed that back in 2007 when it sat on the Security Council, and the U.S. blocked that from proceeding.
There are many people in the world who suspect that another false flag operation will be, in fact, the U.S. response to the Russian and Syrian diplomacy. That is, another explosion of chemical weapons that is laid at the feet of the Assad government.
Putin even raised that in his op-ed, saying that he suspects that the rebels will attack Israel with chemical weapons. I mean, the U.S. media has been unanimous in parroting that it is the Assad government that is responsible, even though the U.S. hasn't provided any evidence. One of the dynamics here that hasn't been really highlighted is that the timing of this is kind of bizarre in that, in terms of the media coverage, in that right now we just had Al Jazeera America crank up, and Al Jazeera and other Gulf media have played an incredibly destructive role in how they have deformed the Arab uprisings, protecting the monarchies and gross exaggerations as far as the republics are concerned, causing at least two civil wars
Libya and Syria. And so I would extremely caution people who regard themselves as progressive, I think, to look upon Al Jazeera as some kind of breath of fresh air from the standard corporate media. And I would caution against that very strongly.
Sam Husseini of the Institute for Public Accuracy in Washington. President Obama has not backed off his threats to attack Syria, no matter what the United Nations says. Norman Solomon, a co-founder of RootsAction.org, says when U.S. presidents want war, they get war.
I can't think of a time in our lifetimes when a president has said, I want to begin bombing another country, and hasn't gotten to do it. You know, it's like one of the, unfortunately, in a tragic way, one of the power levers and perks of being a president, when the guy in the Oval Office has decided, I want to start bombing a country, by hook or by crook, it gets done. And sometimes they go to Congress first, and sometimes they don't. But in this case, with this president, for whatever reasons, he decided, I think through hubris and belief that the traditional way of twisting arms would get it done and get a majority on Capitol Hill, he said, okay, I'll go to Congress. And I really think at that point, he believed he could push it through. And then for a combination of reasons, including that the militarist center could not hold, he couldn't get it done. So, you know, you got to wonder what he could have possibly done to get approval from the House or maybe even the Senate for a war resolution. And so he needed a climb down somehow.
And what would be the prospects if he decided 2 weeks from now that he wants to go ahead with that attack? Would his prospects be better in the House than they were before last Tuesday?
Well, I think there would need to be some very fancy tap dancing and some really innovative propaganda maneuvers to get it through the House in particular. And it is sort of a puzzlement of how it could get done. I mean, I have never been, since Obama announced a couple of Saturdays ago that he was going to go to Congress, I've never been confident that he wouldn't turn around and bomb Syria without congressional approval, either by omission or rejection at a vote. And, you know, given that Boehner in concert with Pelosi in this case and Harry Reid in the Senate control the agenda, I think, Glenn, we could almost say that it's very, very unlikely a vote will reject a war resolution on Syria, because if they don't have the votes, Boehner and Reid are going to pull the resolution and it won't get to the floor to a vote. But that said, then there's a real question in my mind whether Obama won't at some point say, you know, screw these guys in Congress. Of course, he wouldn't say it that way. I believe as commander-in-chief that Syria needs some bombing, and I'm the one to make it happen.
And in fact, he said that he still maintains he has that authority, and essentially he was just doing a courtesy to the Congress.
Yeah, that's sort of the boilerplate, you know, a pat on the head, I want to hear your voice. That has been the rhetoric to keep that door open to the unitary executive or whatever you call it, basically obviating, trashing again, as has happened so often, Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, and saying Congress doesn't have the power to declare war. I do. I'm president. I'm not declaring war, but I'm starting yet another assault on yet another country.
You said you've never seen a president act quite like Obama has regarding war and the U.S. right to start wars whenever it feels like it. But have you ever seen a Congress behave this way in recent years, with Democrats lined up more in favor of a military action than the Republicans?
Well, I think there was some of that during the bombing of Kosovo, where efforts to invoke the War Powers Act came to a tie, which meant in the House failure of Clinton to obtain approval after 60 days of bombing of Kosovo and Serbia. And as usual, Clinton didn't give it a damn and just kept bombing through the leadership of the NATO assault. But never quite this way, in terms of there's no war underway, and at least U.S. overt bombing of Syria not underway, and to have members of Congress balk is unusual. And also, you know, it has to be said that if McCain were president, I think some more Republicans would be backing bombing than now. You know, and that cuts in both directions. If McCain were president, more Democrats would be opposing. I sort of slice the cake this way, that there's a center of both parties, the hierarchies of the Democrats and Republicans on Capitol Hill. They're for war. They're for militarism. They're for what Dr. King called the madness of militarism. Of course, they cloak it in all sorts of holy garments and angelic purposes. And then you have a rebellion, particularly numerically, among Republicans who call themselves, you know, Libertarian or Tea Party, and some Democrats, some of the better ones in the Progressive Caucus primarily, and they're saying, no, this is important enough that we're going to reject the so-called leadership of our parties and we're going to refuse. And I think it is extraordinary in this case that the numbers are so high. And so you have a lot of people who are on the fence who are seeing now that the combination of Libertarian Republicans and Progressive Democrats is a majority in the House. And so there's been a lot of scurrying for cover, I think, in the last few days.
Yes, we didn't get a chance because of the intervention of diplomacy to see how much there really is left of progressive forces within the Democrats in the House.
Yeah, well, I think in the House, they're certainly a minority of the, what they call the Democratic caucus. And I think that in the Progressive caucus, 70-odd members, basically all of them Democrats in the House, there was a split. And as I understand it, most of the no Democratic votes would have been from the Progressive caucus, and most of the caucus would have voted no, but some would have voted for the war resolution. And there is a big problem there on Syria, which has not gone away, which is whereas Ril Grijalva, one of the co-chairs of the Progressive caucus, has been adamant against authorizing bombing of Syria, Keith Ellison, the other co-chair, congressperson from Minnesota, is in favor of a war resolution to bomb. And that's a big problem because it has hamstrung the leadership of the Progressive Caucus to push hard and be a somewhat united force against launching a war against Syria.
Norman Solomon, co-founder of RootsAction.org. Paul Street is an historian and activist who has followed President Obama's career since the early days in Chicago. Street was there in 2002 when State Senator Obama gave the speech that would later allow him to pose as an anti-war candidate for president.
Not as much of an anti-war speech as people wanted to believe it was, liberals in particular. And I remember him going very much out of his way to say that he wasn't against wars, he wasn't against all wars, he was just against what he called stupid wars. And he felt strategically, apparently, that the invasion of Iraq, you know, wouldn't make sense, that it would distract us from what he always saw was the good and noble, which was Afghanistan and the war against so-called Al-Qaeda. And all that, however, when he declared for the U.S. Senate, which was in the works as he was giving that talk, and in fact, that speech, I'm quite convinced, was sort of urged on him by liberal handlers, some of them former members of the New Left, precisely to position him to take advantage of likely opposition to the Iraq War when he ran for the U.S. Senate in 2004. And interestingly enough, the one he declared for the U.S. Senate, that speech came down, and it came down off his website because I guess it was considered something that might antagonize military elites and military contractors and other folks who make a lot of money out of war. And interestingly enough, when he made the speech in Boston in 2004 that turned him into a phenomenon, the Democratic National Convention speech, at the same time he was given that, around the same day, he gave an interview to the New York Times in which he said actually he might have supported the occupation of Iraq if he had access, he said, to the same intelligence that Hillary Clinton and John Edwards had in 2002, which is an interesting statement. It's kind of a rollback. And then around that same time, he told the Chicago Tribune that the issue really wasn't the war per se, but who was in charge of it, that he wanted to get the bad imperialists, namely George W. Bush, out of office, and get the good imperialists, the Democratic presidential candidate, John Kerry, in office. And then, of course, Kerry didn't make it, and he moved towards the presidential candidacy, and he's already dreaming about that from the beginning. And he wrote a book called Audacity of Hope, which was just loaded with the worst kind of American exceptionalist rhetoric about how great America is in the world and only makes mistakes and never commits crimes. He whitewashed all of American imperial history. He whitewashed Vietnam. He whitewashed Chile and, you know, and the 50 governments that we overthrew in the last six decades. And he whitewashed all of that. And he had this interesting line in a foreign policy chapter in that book, The Audacity of Hope, where he said one of the great problems with the Iraq War is that it was going to create popular disenchantment about American foreign policy within the United States and therefore handicap its ability to flexibly fight wars whenever it wanted to, which I always thought was a very interesting comment. His main problem with the Iraq War wasn't that it was killed a million Iraqis, that it violated international law, that the U.S. had deployed chemical weapons against the town of Fallujah. The problem was that it was making imperialism look bad in the eyes of American people, and that could be a problem for future presidents. And so he's looking at that problem right now, where he's got people that he just can't seem to move their opinion on behalf of an illegal, unprovoked criminal attack.
So Obama spends 6 years from 2002 to 2008 capitalizing on the fact or his claim that he would not have voted to give George Bush war powers authority. And now he claims he doesn't even need that authority from Congress to do what he wants to do.
Yeah, well, he didn't seek it in Libya, which was a disaster. He certainly hasn't sought it for the supposedly authorized dirty wars that are being fought all over the Muslim world. Now, all of a sudden, he can seek an authorization for Syria. Of course, now he's going to put it on hold, which is hilarious. But he claims that he's doing this because he realizes he's not just the commander-in-chief, he's also the president of the world's oldest constitutional democracy, which is a fascinating time in and of itself, because democracy was the founder's biggest nightmare. But the truth is that he hasn't sought their authorization on anything, really, not on the dirty wars and not on Libya. The real reason he's seeking authorization right now is he needs a fig leaf. He always needs a fig leaf somewhere. And he had it in Libya. He had it from NATO. He had it from the United Nations. And he's had no luck rallying the so-called international community. He's no luck rallying his allies. He's had no luck rallying public opinion. He had a war-weary public for various types of reasons. Doesn't want anything to do with this. And he's getting it, that this kind of crap leads nowhere but to disaster. And so he's trying to deal him in on his war crime, but he can't. They're actually not constitutionally empowered in any way to make a unilateral attack on Syria legal under international law. It is by definition criminal under the United Nations Charter and under various other aspects of international law that U.S. presidents really don't care about. But, you know, the other thing is he does throw in this caveat, I could do this even if I should, but which is just a raised middle finger by a so-called former constitutional law professor. The intent of the Constitution, which is the Congress, was to be fundamentally dealt into war decisions. It's also a raised middle finger to the post-Vietnam War Powers Act legislation that was passed to try to restrain the imperial presidency. One thing that's dangerous about a guy like JFK or Obama appearing weak, right, it's kind of like a Bay of Pigs moment, all right? And that Bay of Pigs and that need to restore macho credibility and look tough in the world in October of 1962 almost got all of us killed. One of the frightening aspects of this is that Obama's taken such a black eye here. He's been so humiliated that it ups the ante of his need to escalate. And this is a very dangerous part of the world. There are Russian warships that headed to the Mediterranean, the Red Sea. If we were ever to have another Cuban Missile Crisis, you know, superpower nuclear type of scenario, it would kind of start like this. This would be kind of be the part of the world where it would emerge, and this kind of investment of presidential ego and this discussion of red lines, which reminds me of Kennedy's talk about Cuba in September of 1962. It's just nasty stuff in those kinds of ways, and all of humanity hopes that this guy can be restrained. This guy's been vetted by imperial investors and by the military-industrial complex going back decades, well before he got into the White House. He was allied with neoconservatives and the far right during his days in Harvard Law I remember when I worked in the civil rights community in Chicago in the earlier this century, then Obama was notorious for being very close to right-wingers, to being a regular socializer with and poker player with, and to basically hanging out with the far right. He's been very very neocon. Sometimes not even just a neoliberal. He's almost like a neocon. He says nice things about Ronald Reagan. And admitted, almost under the radar screen, it's amazing how it got buried. People don't want to talk about it enough. At the height of his emergent popularity in 2004, admitted that maybe he would have voted for the Iraq War after all. So, you know, none of this should be surprising.
Paul Street is author of the book, The Empire's New Clothes, Barack Obama and the Real World of Power. On October 15th, the U.S. Supreme Court will decide if Michigan has the right to outlaw all forms of affirmative action in government, including higher education. Michigan is appealing a federal court ruling that the state has frozen minorities out of the political process. The affirmative action side in the court battle is represented by BAM, By Any Means Necessary, based in Detroit. Shanta Driver is the lead attorney.
The heart of our claim in this case is that now in the state of Michigan and in the state of California, minorities have been prevented from being able to utilize the political process as equals to any other citizens or groups of people in the state. And specifically, what Prop 2 in Michigan has done is it's prevented Black and Latino and Native American communities and families and students being able to go to the elected regents of the University of Michigan and Michigan State University and Wayne State University and ask that the admission systems of those universities be changed so that more minority, more Black, more Latino, more Native American students can gain entry into those universities. The law bans Black, Latino, and Native American communities from being able to exercise that basic political right. Every other group in the state, alumni, people from Northern Michigan, people who are game day boosters, rich donors, students from rural areas and their representatives, disabled students and their advocates, all of those groups, every other group in the state of Michigan can go to the University of Michigan Regents, ask that the admission system be changed so that more disabled or more rural or more alumni or on and on and on, students are admitted into the University of Michigan. And the only group that is banned from doing that right now are minority communities. If we lose this case, the end result will be that a white majority in the state of Michigan, which has an 85% white electorate, will have been able to take away a fundamental political right in terms of access to the political process from minority communities, and will have been able to end affirmative action programs in our state permanently. And that obviously means the beginning of a new era of the new Jim Crow. So this case is very, very, very important.
Of course, a federal court, a federal appeals court, agreed with your arguments that minorities were not being allowed equal protection under the law.
That's right. And I think that the decision of the Sixth Circuit, which was an en banc decision and we won by one vote, I think is an excellent decision. Whether we can convince this Supreme Court that has on it so many judges that are openly prepared to express racism and skepticism in the fight for real equality in the United States, that's another matter. So we're mobilizing like crazy. We're hoping to have thousands of people out on October 15th, the day that the case is heard before the Supreme Court in Washington, D.C., at the court, so that we can convey to the court that it should do the conservative thing and continue to follow the precedents that were established from the 1960s and 70s that say you can't create laws that discriminate against minorities because they're minorities, and discriminate by eliminating programs or cutting out access to programs for minorities that clearly benefit Black, Latino, and Native American communities.
It would have been a lot of help if the administration had filed a friend of the court brief, but they didn't. Were you surprised?
You know, I wasn't that surprised. In the following, we met with the Solicitor General, and we have met throughout this process with members of the Attorney General's office, really since the beginning of this case, at every stage, asking that they file an amicus brief on our behalf. And what's been interesting is that in every single one of the meetings that we've had, the administration lawyers, the Attorney General's lawyers that we've spoken with, have asked us repeatedly whether what we're saying is that a white majority can't legislate conditions that would deny minority communities their rights. At return, of course, we've said that it's absolutely our position that that would just take us back to the old Jim Crow, that you can't have a situation in which in state after state after state, minorities are denied equal protection under the law, and in which white majorities use their majoritarian strength to subjugate Black, Latino, and Native American to second-class citizenship. And the fact that we've been questioned repeatedly about whether that is our position by the administration lawyers, whether we think that's a defensible position, suggested to me that it was a position that they did not feel that they wanted to be arguing in court. And as a result of that, are just not a part of this case.
Well, can it be said then that this administration is in favor of affirmative action if it takes that position or refuses to take a position?
Yeah, you know, nominally it's in favor of affirmative action, but if you open the door for state after state after state to be able to eliminate affirmative action programs, and in particular in higher education, which has been the key to making so much of the progress that we've made in terms of, not just in terms of creating more doctors and lawyers and professionals and CEOs, but really opening up and changing the whole political character of American society. If you're saying that in principle, you agree with that, but in the case that is going to be the most important and determinative case on the matter, you're not prepared to stick your neck out and speak in behalf of affirmative action and the equal political rights of minorities, then I think it's certainly a kind of support that wins Hala.
You're a lawyer, and BAM, your organization, by any means necessary, has never hesitated to take folks to court. But you do believe that victories are ensured in the streets and not in the courtrooms.
That's exactly true. And in this case, we'll see what happens with the latest immigration reform bill. But what would be really startling and completely incoherent is to have a federal DREAM Act passed this year, which says to undocumented students, overwhelmingly Latino students, okay, the bar to your getting a higher education, the fact that you couldn't get financial aid has been taken away. And now because there's a federal DREAM Act, there's financial aid available to you. But, oh, by the way, the doors of opportunity have been shut tight because affirmative action has ended. And so while you may be able to afford to go to UCLA now, you're not going to have the chance to go there because in the absence of affirmative action programs, you're not getting in. I mean, that would be so incoherent, and it would be such a slap in the face. And to tell you the truth, I think it's the kind of contradiction that is almost certain to lead over time to new urban uprisings, to a movement which grows not just in terms of its numbers, but in terms of its anger and its preparedness to sacrifice everything for the cause of equality.
Shanta Driver of BAM, By Any Means Necessary, in Detroit. Detroit is also the site of an International People's Assembly Against Banks and Austerity to be held on October 5th and 6th. Abayomi Azikiwe, editor of the Pan-African Newswire, is handling communications for the event.
We're asking for the complete cancellation of the debt to the banks, which is strangling the schools, the cities, and states, as well as states and other regions of the country and also countries throughout the world. We want to guarantee workers' jobs, their pensions, their services for the community. We're calling for no union busting. We want a $15 minimum wage for low-wage workers. We want to end the undemocratic racist emergency management of our schools. People need to know around the country and indeed around the world that Detroit is the largest per capita African-American city in the United States, and they have essentially nullified votes of the people inside the city of Detroit in favor of the banks and in favor of the corporations. So those are some of the demands, and we're calling for people to come from throughout the country. If they cannot come, please send us statements of solidarity. We're also soliciting endorsement, people who just give us their political and moral support for this effort.
And what's going to occur during these 2 days?
We have a series of clusters where issues will be discussed from the wholesale charterization and privatization of public education in Detroit. The public school system was put under emergency management prior to the municipal functions of the city, and it's been a total disaster. They have taken public money and turned it over to private corporations, and the same thing is happening with municipal finance as well. We're also going to have a section dealing with the role of the banks in the destruction of the housing sector in Detroit. In the city of Detroit, we've had over 100,000 foreclosures. Some of the largest financial institutions in this country targeted African-American and Latino communities across the United States for predatory lending. And that, of course, has driven literally hundreds of thousands of people out of the city of Detroit. Between 2000 and 2010, Detroit has the largest population loss of any other major city in the country, 237,000 people were literally forced out of the city through predatory lending and job losses, and also illegal utility shutoff as well. So we're going to deal with that issue. We're going to have actions, demonstrations on banks for both days. We're going to have speakers from various community organizations, trade unions, churches who are going to come out. And we're also poising ourselves for the upcoming bankruptcy hearings, the whole constitutionality of the bankruptcy, which many people may not be aware that the bankruptcy is highly political. It was declared by the governor through Kevin Orr, who is working as an emergency manager. He has not been elected by anybody in the city of Detroit or in the state of Michigan. In fact, people voted against emergency management just last November, statewide. So this bankruptcy was done behind the backs of the people of the city of Detroit, and we consider it illegal, and we consider the so-called debt to these financial institutions and these bondholders, which have been strangling Detroit, we consider that to be illegitimate, and we're calling for its complete cancellation. So we have been outside the bankruptcy hearings. At every major hearing, we've had retirees, community organizations outside demonstrating, calling for justice for the pensioners and the workers and the community residents of the city of Detroit, and we're going to continue that in October when they decide on the actual constitutionality of this illegal bankruptcy.
And in fact, not just the residents of Detroit, but the majority of black folks in the state of Michigan have been disenfranchised.
Yes. And this is a total violation of the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution in terms of due process, the 15th Amendment, which ostensibly granted African people the right to vote inside the United States, the 1957 Civil Rights Act, which empowers the Justice Department to intervene when the rights of residents are being violated through the denial of the vote, and the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which has an equal protection clause, and then the 1965 Voting Rights Act. All of these bills, constitutional amendments, are being violated in the state of Michigan, and there's been no intervention by the Justice Department or the White House. In fact, they've said publicly that they're not going to intervene and they're going to allow the banks and the corporations and their agents, through the governor and the emergency manager, to literally restructure Detroit.
And Detroit is the biggest so far, but it's not the only city in the crosshairs of the bankers.
Absolutely not. We've been following the situation in Stockton, California, very closely, where they are in bankruptcy as well, and it's been a big struggle over whether or not they should take the tax money to pay the banks or to pay into the pension funds. San Bernardino, California is also in the same situation. Vallejo, California, and many other cities in California are on the brink of fiscal insolvency. We can look at Providence, Rhode Island, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Birmingham, Alabama is just coming out of a bankruptcy. All of these cities are being impacted. Chicago, Illinois, they just laid off 3,000 teachers. They closed over 50 schools. This is a test case in the city of Detroit. If they can get away with it in Detroit, they're going to take this show on the road to other cities around the United States.
Detroit's 85% black, but your political class didn't seem to put up much of a fight.
No, since the retirement of Coleman Young 20 years ago, we've had a succession of African-American mayors who have taken a totally different political outlook. Coleman Young came out of the labor movement, out of the left movement. He was brought before the House on American Activities Committee in the early 1950s and accused of being a communist. And he stood his ground then, and he continued when he was elected in 1973 to be an advocate for the people of Detroit. He was hated by the many whites in the suburbs, by the corporate media. They did everything they could to denigrate his image. But he held on for two decades. But after that, we've had a succession of mayors who have taken a different position. And now, the current mayor, Dave Bing, didn't even live in the city of Detroit in 2009 when he ran for mayor. He was recruited by the corporate community. He was told specifically to carry out the austerity measures against the city employees and the population in general. And he was not able to carry out his program. So therefore, they put in an emergency manager to carry out the program. But what are they advocating? Are they advocating the floating of more bonds? This is a solution that we've heard that has come out recently from Kevin Orr's office. So they're talking about eliminating the existing debt with more debt and tying that debt to the city assets. For example, the Detroit Institute of Arts, they want to tie it to the water system, to the public lighting system, to Belle Isle, which is one of the largest public parks in the United States. And then in a couple of years, when this collapses, they'll be able to seize control of these public assets and privatize them completely.
So you're saying don't roll over the debt, cancel the debt.
Yes, because a lot of the debt is illegitimate. These are banks specifically targeted African-American communities through predatory mortgage lending and also through municipal finance as well. We look at the deals, and we have the documents on our website, DetroitDebtMoratorium.org. That's DetroitDebtMoratorium.org. We got over 3,000 pages of documents through a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit earlier this year from the City of Detroit's Law Department that has the actual contracts, termination agreements, the interest rate swaps. They're all documented on this website. What they reveal is that Detroit was locked into predatory lending on the municipal finance level. And this is why now they're claiming that the city of Detroit owes $22 billion to these financial institutions. And we're saying the tax base was driven down through the loss of jobs, elimination of whole communities through predatory lending, and this, of course, drove down the tax base. Then the city had to turn around and borrow more money from these same financial institutions like Bank of America, Wells Fargo, UBS, U.S. Bank, and others, to entrap them in predatory municipal loans at high interest rates with extravagant termination agreements. For example, the declaration of a financial emergency, which prompted the appointment of a financial manager, cost the city of Detroit over $400 million. Just the appointment of an emergency manager, that tacked another $400 million on the city's debt. So you can see these banks and these bondholders and these insurance companies are out to make even more money on this so-called financially distressed situation in Detroit.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. And while you're there, check out the latest episode of Black Agenda TV. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.